of Griffith University Oral History. This interview is with Professor Calvin Rose. Calvin, you are one of the original professors appointed to the unique School of Australian Environmental Studies. Now, how did the three questions? How did you first hear of Griffith? How did your appointment come about? And what year was this?
Well, I think I first heard of Griffith through the newspaper. I'd heard that there was going to be some new universities, and at the time I was working with CSIRO for a decade after having been in a university in Uganda in East Africa prior to that.
Oh.
And I always felt it would be nice to get back again, though I enjoyed very much my decade of research in CSIRO. I heard that there was a couple of new universities, but the actual information about Griffith first came through the advertising of the position of foundation chairman, as it was called in those days.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I followed this up. I, in fact, on CSIRO business, I had to visit Brisbane, and I took the time to meet up with John Topley, who was about the sole member of the university, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
This was, I think, quite early on.
Do you remember which year?
I think it would have been about 1970 or 71.
Ah, yes.
Mm-hmm. And he very kindly took me to lunch. In fact, we had a very good lunch, if I remember. And he seemed very interested in both the university and in the possibility that I might apply for it.
Good.
And so that's how it came to be. Well, I think my formal application was probably in 1972,
mm-hmm.
though it was early 73 when I actually arrived, because I had to finish up some things in CSIRO that I was with, and it seemed acceptable to the university that an arrival early in 73 was possible.
You were the first dean, or chairman, as it was then called, of Australian Environmental Studies, and you're again dean in 1992, this year. You must have seen and taken part in extraordinary changes over the years.
Yes, indeed. I think I'm the only first dean to be recycled, as it were, which is perhaps appropriate in a Faculty of Environmental Sciences. Still around, and I've taken it on for another 3 years, which will be completed in the middle of next year. And yes, the changes, of course, were from the very early stages where the university facility was being planned, and the early four original schools, as they were then called, the term faculty being a very recent origin. And I arrived, of course, as the first appointee to the faculty, or to the school, or to the division, in fact, as it was then called, the division and school terminology being the same. And now, of course, we have a faculty with four schools, including still, as the biggest and oldest, the regional school, which we've now called the Australian School of Environmental Studies, because the term Australian Environmental Studies, to some, especially those outside Australia, seemed to give the connotation that it was concerned wholly and solely and exclusively
with
the Australian environment.
Mm.
So, and since, of course, our work is worldwide, although focused a good deal on Australia, we're working on a worldwide basis, and so we've changed that name. But we have three other schools in addition. In order of their appearance, I guess the School of Applied Mathematics and Statistics, or SAMS as we call it, which is housed in our faculty but which we share with our science and technology colleagues in terms of input to it, and our School of Environmental Engineering, which was an idea that I claim is the origin of, that's now in its entering into its third year of teaching next year. And our Graduate School of Environmental Sciences and Engineering, which was, again, the first graduate school in the university, which caused a whole re-examination of what the term school meant, which in the early days meant an undergraduate program.
Mm.
And so the statute book had to be rewritten a little bit to accommodate that.
Mm. Where was your first office?
It was in the Humanities Building, which is one of the early buildings that was completed. And a very nice office it was, but the whole space there, in the very early planning, the Australian Environmental Studies School was conceived, oddly enough, I mean it was an extremely great innovation for the university to think in those days, the late 60s, early 70s, of an academic unit focusing on environmental sciences. But the very early planning that was done conceived of the school as not having any significant experimental activity. Uh-huh. And hence there was no laboratories or anything of that nature planned at all. And so, therefore, the Humanities building was the most suitable building that they could put us in, because the Science building was not that large, the initial Science 1 building, and there was really no room there. For us to exist.
When you first came to the site then, the Humanities Building was already up and Science 1 was already built?
No. I saw it at the stage where the only building that was visible was the squash courts.
And really?
Yes, although the squash courts were used as, in fact I've had quite a good number of planning meetings and early meetings were held in the squash courts. And what is now the gymnasium was the offices of the, what is now the facilities. And that was all it was. There was just about beginning clearing for the other major, the two early buildings, but they weren't up by any means.
What was your impression of the site in those days?
Well, I was a little surprised to find, although I didn't know Brisbane well, I did know that the site was not that far from the centre of the city. And I was pleasantly surprised that there was such an area of bushland reserved for what turned out to be now a university. And certainly it raised issues that provided an opportunity for a quite unusual and unique development of a campus, because I knew virtually all the other campuses in Australia, I think at the time, and they were certainly surrounded by mown grass and clipped hedges and all that sort of thing.
Yes.
And quite obviously there was an opportunity here to do something quite different. And Roger Johnson, the first site planner, had already taken that point on well on board and had some very interesting ideas as to how the university might be planned.
Mm. Who are the people you remember from the early days? You mentioned Roger Johnson, but
well, of course, meeting John Topley as the very first contact with the university, he is well in my memory, and though, of course, we've not seen so much of him in recent years. But, of course, very soon after that, I came to the university and met with John Willett, the first Vice-Chancellor, and he certainly made an impression upon me in terms of the early thinking, and also Ted Bray, or Sir Theodore Bray, as you know, is I met quite early on as well, and they were the folk that, together with others, that I met during the interview that I had, which led ultimately to the appointment. And John Willett had me around in those days, all the early first chairperson appointees, I think, to check out on their how they'd fit in socially. They were brought around to a very nice evening meal at the Willetts' home, Joan and John, in which was over in Kenmore. And I met up with Val Presley, who was the only other appointee at that time, and he was on the early board. And, of course, Ted Bray and other members of the early planning group were there.
Mm-hmm.
And but once, of course, the university got going, I can remember very well, of course, the other first chairman. I've mentioned Val, but there was also Ho Ping Yoke came on the scene fairly soon. Gus Guthrie was an early arrival as well. And Kevin C, I remember very well, as being concerned with trying to hold the finances together without much staff in the early days. And, of course, Arthur Brownlee, the other foundation chairman to the school, was appointed some 6 or 8 months after I arrived. And so, of course, I interacted very strongly with him, both in Sydney where he was at Macquarie University, and of course when we joined up as the initial planning team.
Val Presley was Professor Presley, wasn't he? And he was, right. And as all the other people that you mentioned, were professors. But you, there's a sort of tradition at Griffith of first name terms and not of, you know, mention of rank. Is this so?
I think one of the features of Griffith when it started was that we were a small institution. The numbers of students, of course, were small, and we got to know them very, very well indeed. And it just seemed natural because we were, both students and staff, felt obviously engaged in something of an experiment of how you develop not only a new institution, but environmental studies. There was no agreed way in which that was developed. And so we all felt, to some extent, engaged in an experiment together. Mm-hmm. And there was a number of mature age students, and of those students who came straight from school, they seemed to have, in hindsight, a sense of purpose and maturity, which it seemed just natural to use first name terms. And I'd come, of course, from in the last 10 years of my work prior to coming here with CSIRO, and there, of course, everything was first name terms.
Was it?
Yes. Oh. So it just seemed natural to me, and I'm not sure whether it was natural to everybody else, but it certainly was very natural to me, and we just worked that way from the beginning.
And it worked well?
Yes, it did. I think it gave there wasn't that sense of distance between student and staff that I think is a good thing, and is still to this day a feeling amongst students where, again, first names are used and where we mix in common rooms and so forth, that was a helpful way. Mm. And I think to some extent the students respect the fact that there's a distance in some respects in terms of assessment and other matters of discipline and so forth, but that nevertheless one can talk together. I think it's a flavour that's been a characteristic of the university since the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think it's very much appreciated by the students.
Please, sir.
What were some of the problems you faced in those days?
Well, I guess that some of the problems that we faced were questions that as to what was environmental studies, how did we develop a coherent way of thinking about environmental issues. We certainly had a group of staff, and I'd been a member of an environmental biology group in CSIRO. I think CSIRO was in some ways ahead of the universities in thinking about environmental matters, and I'd been a member for 10 years of an environmental biology group, which I don't think in those days you could have found a group like that in universities. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the problems, I think, were just not that we didn't have plenty of ideas and concerns and an awareness of issues, of environmental problems, particularly in Australia, but what kind of coherent program could you develop? How broadly could you spread oneself? And since we started with a blank sheet of paper, as it were, I felt very strongly that we ought to include the whole range of what often in universities are called disciplines. Mm-hmm. Working in CSIRO for 10 years, we really didn't worry about disciplines. We worried about the problems we were dealing with. We had all sorts of peoples with all sorts of backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And sure, we recognised that folk had different strengths and backgrounds, but these often covered across disciplines, and that really wasn't the basis of our organisation at all. But there was certainly a recognition that a lot of the information, a lot of the texts, a lot of the methodologies that were required at the early undergraduate stage were often dressed up, as it were, in disciplinary terms, and how to take those, make use of them, and weld them into an environmental studies curriculum that inherently was dealing with issues which were not addressable in disciplinary terms. If you think of the major issues in environmental matters to this day or at that day, they just don't come along dressed up in the way that physics or mathematics or chemistry or sociology can deal with. So they were some of the important sort of basic problems that we dealt with in those days. There was certainly some constraints into how we developed our program because, as I mentioned, the early planning in the university for environmental studies was one that had no laboratories component, so we had to try and bring on stream as early as we could, and the university collaborated there by developing a temporary building, which has only just been demolished in recent weeks, that did in fact house our laboratory activities.
The environment was not at that time the popular cause it is today. I mean, you touched on that already. Did you have any difficulty in attracting students?
No, we certainly didn't have any trouble in attracting students. Rather the reverse. We had a very, very good and very interested and motivated cohort of students. But I think, too, if it's going back in history, at that time there really was a very real initial concern with environment worldwide at that time. Mm-hmm. There may have been somewhat of a lull following it, but in those, I'm talking here about the early and mid-70s, these issues were certainly newer in terms of their worldwide recognition, but there was no question that these issues were being raised. And so whilst it hadn't reached the stage of maturity, the stage where environmental matters these days are seen as a normal part of proper planning and consideration of possible developments, nevertheless, there was a very widespread concern and indeed alarm as to what was going on in terms of human use and disposal of waste. There was a wide range of concerns. So I think it was very much a live issue, and it's true, of course, that in universities at that time, many, especially I think the older established universities, certainly hadn't caught up with that. And there was not the same degree of interest and a bit of, I suppose, concern as to just exactly what environmental studies was.
You mentioned that the CSIRO was vitally concerned with it, and there were overseas scientists also interested in it, mm-hmm. but not so many scientists within Australia, apart from the CSIRO.
No, that's concerned. Right. I think at that stage, I think that CSIRO, and in particular our environmental biology group in the Division of Land Use Research, was, looking back on it, perhaps one of the biggest and most rounded concerns, although centres of concern, although the economic and social dimensions were not terribly well represented there. At that stage, Ralph Stutcher, who's been the Chief Minister until recently, was the head of the group that I was with, which I then headed for a period of time. And he went to ANU, leaving CSIRO, to start up environmental concerns, though it was an environmental biology group, and that was one of the early developments. Since, as I've said before, the response of the universities was not, in those days, very, very great.
No. Do you remember how many academic staff you began with and how many students there were in the first intake?
When we started teaching, we had 7 staff, including all up, of an academic nature. Mm. And we had the support of a couple of administrative people. We took in, it was either somewhere in the range of 60 to 70 in the initial intake. Mm-hmm. Whereas today, of course, we've got something like 65 academic staff, mm-hmm. and something of the order of nearly 1,000 students, about 700 undergraduate and about 200 in the postgraduate areas of master's programs, honours, and our research degrees, which we call MPhil for the master's level, yeah. And the PhD.
The the faculty is now called Australian Environmental Sciences, isn't it?
Just a Faculty of Environmental Sciences.
Faculty of Environmental Sciences. So we've let the Australian, the Australian School of Environmental
Studies.
Studies.
And so AES is still there. The original, we wanted to maintain the worldwide recognition of AES is very well established in terms of our recognition worldwide, and so with the Australian School of Environmental Studies we've kept the AES alive, but of course we've got our environmental engineering and our other schools as well. But the faculty, we felt best to keep the name short, and we've just called it Environmental Sciences.
Sciences, yes. When did you take your first postgraduate students, and how many were there in this first group?
Well, the very first postgraduate student was Greg McKeon, who worked with me in Katherine in the Northern Territory, where I was working for many years with CSIRO on a visiting basis from Canberra. And he was very interested in pasture stability and the establishment of and stability of tropical pasture legumes, Townsville stylo and so forth. And he wanted to do a PhD. So I said, well, I think we can accommodate that. We haven't really got much started in terms of facilities at Griffith, but I'd arranged with the agreement at the university, which they thought was a bit of a novel idea, that he'd spend some of his time at Katherine with supervision from my colleagues in CSIRO there, some of his time in Canberra, where other colleagues were very well able to look after him, and some of his time at Griffith.
Yeah.
And so he was he's now a leading member of the ecological modelling group in DPI, Department of Primary Industries in Queensland. And fairly soon after that, and I can't quite remember exactly when, but Peter Coldrake, who's now well known in Queensland, was another quite early PhD student, supervised by Arthur Brownlee. So we've generated not only those two, but many very interesting people.
And Peter did his PhD in AES.
In AES. Yeah,
mm-hmm. Realised that. Of course, he was ultimately dean of, I think it was in the days when it was chairman of CAD, Commerce and Administration.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes.
Yes, it just shows the width, I think, of environmental studies, that folk can, with that background, go on to many, many different areas, and that is very true. One of the difficult questions in a sense, to answer is the common question of where do your students gain employment, because the answer is everywhere.
Yes.
Even though, of course, there are a good number of areas where you can see congregations of students.
Yes. Peter, incidentally, then went on to the state government to become in charge of the restructuring of the public service.
That's right. That's been a major...
Major undertaking, yes.
Indeed.
Mm. Now, today you have a large number of postgraduates doing higher degrees. What are the most notable and innovative areas of their research?
Well, I could go on this for a long time, but
we've got plenty of time.
But one of the areas...
Because this is important.
It is, yes, that's right. One of the areas I think that's very important and innovative and notable is the whole area of sustainable land use. And we have here quite a number of students, both from within Australia and in my own case, we have students from East Africa, from Kenya, from the Philippines, from Ethiopia, and all countries where the dependence of the country's livelihood on the continued production of land, where land use pressures are very great, and of course in Australia itself, where our land pressures, especially on our arid and semi-arid lands, are likewise very great. And so this whole issue of how to use land in a way that's compatible with its long-term productivity is one where I think that we in the school and in the faculty have really got quite a long and proud history. And that's still going on. Putting things together has also been, I think, a major feature. For example, our Centre for Catchment and In-Stream Research.
I was thinking of that.
Directed by Angela Associate Professor Andrew Arthington is a good example, I believe, of where ecologists and biologists and land managers and physical scientists work together, looking there at the ways in which the use of land resources and perhaps the abuse of land resources can affect in-stream water quality, and then what does that mean in terms of the ecosystems that depend for their ongoing life, good quality water of reasonable quality and so forth. And so I think that's an area, and of course that ultimately attracted the support of ARAC as it was, or the old WWRDC as it now is, and that's an ongoing centre of activity. Another area that sometimes surprises people is the strength and range of our mathematical modelling activities, including analytical and statistical and, of course, computing simulation techniques. And a question one often gets is, why is that so important? Why is that such an important research area? Well, I worked, my background was originally in the sciences and engineering and mathematics, and I, working a fair bit of my life with agricultural scientists and biological scientists of various kinds, I could see how often they were limited or hamstrung in their work by limitations in their mathematical training, because in those days, quite often, if you didn't like mathematics, well, you did biology or something else. And some of them struggled valiantly to overcome these problems, and some succeeded. But mathematics seems to be an area where if you don't get it early on, it becomes more difficult. And so in our school, the Australian School of Environmental Studies, we've always had a strong mathematical focus, and where it's appropriate, that can be carried on into later years, and of course our School of Applied Mathematics and Statistics. But that's one area, bringing mathematical modelling abilities to look at environmental issues is one very notable feature. And the range of these is quite incredible, ranging from global warming issues, where you're trying to model the whole atmospheric environment and its interactions with the Earth, through to much more questions of trying to model salinity changes as through time and space, as some of the salinity problems present themselves. Another area that's, I think, not common is issues, specific issues to do with urban issues. Noise, for example, is something we often take for granted, but Lex Brown and some of his students are carrying out some very innovative work in how to deal in planning with cities in terms of reduction of exposure to noise. We, of course, now have our new School of Environmental Engineering, and it's taking on some very interesting projects. One specific one is concerned with the use, effective use of cement kilns, which are dependent on energy supplies, and how some of our so-called wastes, such as rubber tyres, for example, which have reached the end of their life, they're mostly oil and can provide wonderful fuel for cement kilns. So this is making use, as it were, making positive economic use of what otherwise is a disposal problem.
Yes, that's absolutely marvellous. You've seen pictures of those on television programmes, news programmes, of those dreadful tyre fires in the south. I think they were both, or the two that I saw were both in Sydney or in New South Wales somewhere.
Yes, there's been one in Brisbane at
was
least.
Was one?
And enormous ones overseas.
Yes.
They're very difficult to put out because it's a pyrolysis process. So that's an indication that the sort of quite new areas of research emerging. Just to give a bit of balance, another, I think, very important and long-term important issue is the relationship between our Aboriginal community and land. Athol Chase and others have spent a lifetime trying to better understand the great affinity that our Aboriginal community have for the land which they've occupied for so many tens of thousands of years, I think the last number was evidence of at least 40 or 50,000 years of occupation, yeah. Which is quite incredible by world archaeological and historical standards. And understanding not only their background, but their views of their relationship to land, and of course dealing with the very great problems that they face when issues of land development, such as mining or other uses that present them with great difficulties. I think that's a particularly Australian issue which we can learn from, I hope, a great deal.
We have quite a number of Aboriginal students at the university now. Are they involved in your faculty?
There have been a few. One of the things we've been trying to give more attention to in the recent past is to draw the attention to the Aboriginal community, the very suitable, we believe, very suitable education that they could receive in this school. And whilst we've had some postgraduates and a few small numbers, we believe that we should see considerably more Aboriginal students in our school, particularly the school, Australian school, and I hope that that happens.
That's good. You mentioned Professor Arthur Brownlee earlier. The work that he and some of his students did in community health.
That's another.
Is a very interesting
notable
area.
Yeah, that's right, indeed, although he's now with our health and behavioural sciences faculty. He really developed the strong link with health interests, between health and environment interests, that have very much persisted within the faculty, and he did some very innovative work and is continuing to do so. We see the fruits of his interests in our current master's programs, include a master's in environmental community health, which we still offer. The fact also that we have jointly with the University of Queensland and QUT a master's program in public health, and of course one of our concentration areas of interest is in pollution and health, that relationship, and now in collaboration with our health and behavioural sciences we're involved with the workplace and health issue, and that's an area that is in fact we plan to grow in, as I'll mention a little later.
How did you go about planning the first courses? And what were the original courses or programs?
Well, there was two sort of phases, I suppose. Arthur Brownlee and I were the first appointees, and we collaborated together as soon as it became clear that he would be appointed. Then my own thinking was much enriched. We were compatible in many ways, because he was a geographical scientist with a social bent, if you like, and I was more on the physical, biological, mathematical side of things. Mm-hmm. So we had some very exciting and very, I think, significant progress made in terms of the broad framework and the kinds of courses that ought to be put in place. Then, of course, we got to appoint some staff, and we appointed another five or so, ranging from the mathematical to the social area. Mm-hmm. And at that stage, we had a small group accommodated in the Salisbury area of the university's existence. We had small meetings from time to time, quite regularly, putting flesh on the bones, and in some cases quite substantially modifying the very early ideas that we had. And so those early times prior to the commencement of teaching in 1975 were pretty intense periods. And an interesting feature was that there was a very strong interaction with all the other three schools as well. And so we all had pretty good ideas as to what was going on in the three schools. And a most exciting time.
I was just going to use that word. It must have been a very exciting time, particularly for you in Modern Asian Studies, because these were the two unique schools, unique areas that Griffith was taking on.
Yes, we were all together virtually in one office, and sitting next to us within touching distance was staff from Modern Asian Studies.
So yes.
You couldn't but, in fact, some of our meetings got so boisterous, apparently, that we were causing a bit of disturbance to humanity, so I remember at one time, who were very interested in what we were talking about, but didn't want to hear it in quite such great volume. Yes.
What was the greatest difficulty you faced in those early days?
Well, personally, coming from, although I'd been in universities, as I mentioned, in East Africa, in a physics department, they're coming from 10 years in CSIRO, where we worked very much in substantial teams, it was quite a change coming to university. Universities have some funny ways of doing things, and I needed a bit of adjustment, I think, to that. But I suppose over the trying to get on top of what were not only one's personal interests in environmental matters, but what is the entire gamut of environmental concerns that society had was something that I put quite a bit of energy into, and tried to then see what all that meant in terms of the kind of programs that we ought to develop. Mm-hmm. So it was, whilst everybody has their interests and concerns, charged with the development of an entire new program and given the opportunity to develop it without any particular constraints, trying to come to grips with the whole range of environmental concerns and their implications for curriculum development, I think was probably in many ways the most daunting problem.
I would imagine it would be. Terrific. The university policy, looking back at students now and the teaching of students, the university policy of not demanding prerequisites from students seeking to enrol could be expected to involve difficulties in the science area. Did it?
Yes, I think it did. I must say, though, that it was a policy that, when we call it university policy, in those early days when there was such a small number, university policy was something we as first deans had quite a bit to do with. Yes. So I must admit that I was one that was favouring, especially for our own school, this question of prerequisites. I had a fairly good look around at the question of prerequisites, and there was no doubt then, as perhaps still is today, that there's a certain amount of nonsense in prerequisites, in that you can find quite different prerequisites for the same course and the same prerequisites for quite different courses. So there was a feeling beginning afresh that this was something that perhaps was some extent historically dictated and needed rethinking. Mm-hmm. We recognised that not having prerequisites was going to make for a demanding teaching environment, because bringing in students with such a wide range of backgrounds and providing them in 3 years in a past degree the opportunity to get up to the kinds of standards that one would expect in universities was not something, not a problem that we should look at lightly. And the science area, but also because of my feeling that we must give substantial emphasis to mathematical area, that was an equal problem, perhaps in some respects a greater problem. I certainly consulted fairly widely with respect to mathematics that if we were going to make a quantitatively strong bias, a feature of the school, that I was told universally that therefore one must have mathematics prerequisites, and that you're crazy to think otherwise. Mm-hmm. Well, I was crazy and thought otherwise. So we've been doing that for nearly 20 years now, so it's not completely crazy. But it certainly did make me realise that we had to do something very different in terms of how we went about teaching, especially in the first year. Mm. And so I talked to our one or two mathematicians that we had, or folk with that sort of background, and said, look, we've got a real problem here that if we don't address very early on, we're going to get into difficulties. And so out of this, and before any teaching began, we developed this book that is still used to this day, and with very little alteration, a book called Self-Pacing in Mathematics, SPIM, which has been very widely used, not only in this university, but
yes,
elsewhere.
Yes, I think I've seen it.
Yes, indeed. So that had its origin in this very point that we're discussing, that if we're not going to have subject prerequisites, and we'll have students coming in, as we did and do, with as much mathematics as the school system can throw at them, no mathematics much at all, or it's all forgotten, how do you cope with that uneven background?
Yes.
Well, we still cope and have coped, but it has been greatly assisted by the self-pacing in mathematics, where folk can go, to some extent, at their own pace, although the pace can be too slow. It depended, its success, to some extent, on there being the opportunity, finally, if the student could not understand the problem as evidenced by not passing little tests that they could attempt as many times as they liked, then ultimately there was the opportunity to talk one-to-one with a tutor.
I see.
And that worked. The only problem is that as the university's resources got whittled away gradually over the years, the resources to do that have become more and more difficult.
Yes.
And so in recent years, we've had to look at alternative ways of dealing with that economic problem, if you like, by using computer-aided instruction. And we invested a couple of years ago in a person to help us with that. And it looks as though, although there's more evaluation needed and more in the way of development needed, that there has been considerable progress in that area. In the sciences area, we had some help in getting a self-pacing in chemistry, again based on self-pacing, and again we've had to change the ways in which we deliver that, largely through economic reasons.
This means, does it, that the student reads the book, doesn't have lectures on the book, but reads the book, and at a certain time says, I think I can cope with up to this, and then you give him a little test on it, on a certain,
basically,
him
that's
or
it.
Her.
Basically, that's it. We have used lectures in a sort of a supplementary way, and perhaps the importance of that has increased in recent years. But nevertheless, it's basically as you say, and it depends a lot on the fact that the book is very well developed for the particular problem in mind, and that there are test exercises within it, and that then they can try these out, and then this process of interaction between trying to be able to deal with the problems and then seeing whether they can get through little tests, which are not exams in the traditional sense.
No.
They're simply a test of mastery.
Yes.
And with mathematics being half right, it's not terribly useful. And so it requires pretty complete mastery before then folk can go on to the next unit, as it were. And that's still in place today. And we're talking only as recently as yesterday with our division of Faculty of Education as to how we might keep this progress going in terms of trying to make use of computer-aided instruction, because it does offer the opportunity of reduced costs and yet having this self-pacing aspect associated with it. But it's been a difficult area to get the fruits. It's been talked about for decades, the value of computer-aided instruction, but it depends very much on the quality of educational understanding that goes into it. The technological side is really the minor, but although an important issue as well.
Yes, I can quite see that. Did AES follow the Griffith pattern of giving all first-year students a common foundation year?
It did. Yes, that was the agreed way of dealing with the foundation year, and of course the main reason for that, or an important reason for it, was to delay the necessity of a student making a decision as to exactly what area they would, or areas they would, concentrate in. One of the problems, I think, faced by students, especially those coming straight from school, is that decision as to what they're going to do.
Yes.
If they're dead mad sure they want to do dentistry, well, that's not a great problem.
Yeah.
In they go if they're accepted. But for the majority of students is in a more general degree, such as a BSc, just what area their interests lie may well be affected, perhaps greatly, by the quality of the teaching they've received at school. Some particular teacher has turned them on, some particular teachers have perhaps turned them off.
Yes.
And there may even be areas of study that they haven't even thought about in or touched on in their school. And in the first year, which was called a first year in those days, and the term foundation year was not in use, funnily enough. That's a later accretion.
Yes.
The term that was used was a foundation course, which was a component of the for the first year. In addition to the foundation course, which was an integrative activity, there were other supportive courses, which, for example, the self-pacing in mathematics was one, and our physical sciences program was another, and so forth. But the foundation course there was to try and provide a unified, integrated view of the world from an environmental bias. And so we started off by looking at how did the world form, you know, right from plate tectonics through the continental drift and the kind of processes that act and develop soil and the interaction with hydrologic processes, the way in which we depend on that, the sorts of soils and landscape processes that take place, through to agricultural and biological and ecological issues and how the landscape and plants develop and the animals develop, through to populations and populations of animals, through to populations of humans and the problems that gives rise to, and the human concerns and how society organises itself and shares resources through economic activities and the like. How do we deal as societies? What's culture? You know, we threw them into the context, as most students didn't realise they had a culture. Well, if you look at an Aboriginal culture, a very different culture, you realise you've got one too. And it may be, and so that whole gamut of looking at the world, really, through to, you know, legal and administrative issues as well, and governments, was this foundation course, as it was called. And the remnants, in transformed form, that's still there.
I've always found the AES students are very strongly motivated and dedicated to their studies, and I can quite understand from what you've just said, you know, makes me almost want to go and to try out myself.
Well, they got a view of the world, put it
yes,
that way,
yes,
you know, which
exactly.
was integrated,
yes.
And I think that's still true.
Sounds marvellous.
Mm-hmm.
Was the school involved in the early years? Oh, one of the things I meant to say, coming back to the CSIRO, because we might forget this.
Mm-hmm.
At some stage, about 4 or 5 years ago, there was there became an association between CSIRO and Griffith, didn't there?
Yes.
And does it still continue?
Yes, I've used, right from the very first postgraduate student, I've used suitable research persons to help in the programs, both in terms of supervision of students, and must be nearly half my students have had some supervision from CSIRO staff. And that's still going on today. In fact, one of my students from Ghana is up in Toowoomba right now getting a program that involves use of field station facilities, which, of course, we don't have, but which CSIRO has.
I remember Paul Safinia was terribly anxious that there should be this association between the CSIRO and Griffith, and he was talking to me about it before a council meeting in which the whole matter was going to come up.
Mm. Yes, it could develop further than it has, but we've certainly had ongoing and continuous, very useful interactions and supervision over a long period of time.
Oh, that's marvellous. Was the school involved, or AES involved, in the early years with the development of the ecological environment at Griffith?
Yes, in the very early years, for about the first 2 years, where the numbers of staff and so forth were quite small, we had quite a substantial input into the very early planning, together with Roger Johnson, and the early facilities manager at that time. Sadly, I think the expertise that's in the school has been not fully utilised, and to some extent I guess we feel a bit squeezed out and not the opportunity these days to make any substantial input into the management of the environment from an ecological and from a general and a management point of view. I think there's a lot of skill and knowledge which could be made much more use of. It's not to say we don't have a representative in some committees, but there's a lot more skill that could be made use of, and I guess the recent bushfire management of the site is just one example of that.
Do you think? Oh, you have got people on the site planning committee, haven't you?
Yes, they have a say, as I say, but it's a say, and I don't think that the full range of skills is made full use of.
Now, just as a matter of interest, how do you think that input from AES could have helped in the problem of this dreadful fire in the car parks?
Well, I think most of the school who's been involved in close association with the site were very aware of a very heavy fuel load in that part. It had not been burnt for many, 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 many years.
And that's the undergrowth?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. If you walk through it, as I've done myself, then fallen timber and leaves and so forth were coming up to, if not to your knee, well up. And that's a sign that if ever that got on fire, it would move very quickly and with great intensity. But, it wasn't our responsibility, as it were, to... I think this is commented upon, but we didn't perhaps make as much of it as we should in hindsight. Mm. But the kind of knowledge is made some use of. For example, in the importance of hollow trees has been recognised in when the recent excavation was carried out for the environmental engineering building. Then facilities did shift one of the trees at our suggestion, mm-hmm. That was a tree with hollows that had sugar gliders, and it's
been re-established
elsewhere.
It's been
put elsewhere, yeah. So I shouldn't say that no use is made of the specialised knowledge, but I think that compared with the early days, which is what we're discussing here, where we had we felt we had a very substantial input to the planning and management in those first couple of years. Mm-hmm. Since that time, I think that our input has dwindled quite somewhat, and maybe it's just a question of growth and size. I don't know.
Perhaps, yes.
But it's a resource that could be made more fully use of. For example, sometimes external consultants have been used by the university, and the results of those, I'm not perhaps the one to judge, but I think that the school that we have in the school, we could have also done a good job.
I see. Mm-hmm. Of course, we do have the problem of the vegetation protection orders, which mm-hmm. the Brisbane City Council has applied to the campus, mm-hmm. and that means that we can't do anything very much on the campus in a physical sense, environmentally physical sense, without permission from the council. In other words, I don't think we can burn off.
Well, I think that...
burn fire breaks.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the way in which local government, including in this case the Brisbane City Council, is involved is just simply reflecting changes that are taking place Australia-wide. Mm-hmm. And I think that whilst we had a little difficulty, that was perhaps with how the university reacted initially with respect to the council, in my view, mm-hmm. which is perhaps not shared by everybody. Mm-hmm. But I think that we could have dealt more productively, and I was involved myself in just one small aspect of that, with trying to collaborate more effectively with respect to the siting of an environmental studies centre. And so I saw some of the kinds of interactions that took place between the university and the Brisbane City Council, and I think that it could have been handled better, in my view.
Uh-huh. What was the atmosphere of Griffith like when teaching began in 1975? There wasn't a very large number of students. There weren't a very large number of staff. What was it? Carefree atmosphere? Was it a very serious atmosphere?
I've used the word exciting, and that's the one that comes back to mind again.
Good.
I think we felt very much that it was a small place, as you say. It was. You knew every student by name. You knew every student reasonably well, which is certainly quite impossible these days.
Yes.
And so you had the feeling of a very big family to some extent, engaged in a pretty exciting operation that everybody believed in very strongly and very deeply. And so all sorts of interesting things came from that attitude. We used to be able to get together, for example, every 2 or 3 weeks at lunchtime and say, you know, how are things going, what are the problems? There were some problems, and they all came out fairly readily. So that style, instead of having to depend on a more structured kind of existence, which of course we have to depend on with a big institution, was supplemented very strongly by this immediacy of regular get-togethers. The common room was not nearly as crowded and as it is these days, and so the opportunities for interaction of an informal nature, both between staff and students, was very much better than it perhaps is today.
Mm-hmm.
But the atmosphere, I think, was one of involvement, excitement, feeling that the environmental issues were of great importance to the students and to the staff, to Australia and to the world generally, and that we were in the beginning of developing programs that were addressing these kinds of issues.
And what was the most significant feature of the early years at Griffith? Was it this association between students and staff, or was it the smallness and the fact that you knew everybody, or what do you think is...
I think all those that you've mentioned were significant features of the early years. In academic terms, I think a very significant feature was what I call unconscious interdisciplinarity. This has been discussed recently in the at university senior get-togethers, and I think that more strongly than any other faculty, I think the Faculty of Environmental Sciences has seized the great importance of knowledge developed in a way that should certainly include disciplinary knowledge. In a sense, you can't have interdisciplinary knowledge without disciplinary knowledge. But dealing with the kinds of real concerns of society that are illustrated in environmental issues needs to call on and depends upon an ability of folk with different kinds of background and therefore different kinds of disciplinary knowledge to be able to work together and see the problem whole.
Mm-hmm.
And that unconscious, that kind of discussion in universities about interdisciplinarity or multidisciplinarity or that often appears to us to take place in a very artificial sort of way, you know, and feeling that if you can connect discipline A to discipline B, like physics to chemistry or something, you've really achieved something. But it was not nearly as conscious as all that. It was really a response to a creation of a knowledge, a kind of knowledge that depended upon the knowledge base, which often does get along in disciplinary terms. But how do you put that together? How do you mobilise that kind of knowledge? Was, I think, a very significant feature of the attempts in the early years to try and develop a degree of coherence and a degree of depth, but one in which it wasn't just, well, you know, this week we do, or this course does physics and this one does ecology and this one does sociology and this one does economics, and it's up to you to put it all together.
Where did the idea of interdisciplinarity and or problem solving, and one was attached to the other, wasn't it? Where did this originally come from? Did it arise out of the discussions that the academics had together, or was it one individual person's idea?
It would be interesting to examine the records of the first council, because I think they certainly, if they didn't use that kind of words, certainly they created a conceptual environment that was very conducive to this. I think that that council was very influential in the very early thinking, and had it done less than it did, it could have influenced how things grew. But certainly, if it was not explicit, it was certainly the kinds of words that came and the kinds of documentation that I hope is still around from that first council would have made it certainly very provide a very suitable environment for the kind of thinking that I was that you've indicated, where the words like problem oriented, that in other words, that you tried to develop curriculum in such a way that there was a capacity to deal with real issues,
yes,
without so stripping them down that they could not be adequately addressed.
Yes,
so,
and if this discipline didn't have the problem-solving ability by itself, then you looked for other disciplines where there would be some opportunity for cooperation.
Yes, and very even when disciplinary terms are used, for example, we have a course in...
I'll need to change the tape, sorry.
Oh, sorry.
Right. Mm-hmm. Ian, talking about... Okay.
What do we go back to, Ian?
I just resume that conversation. We stopped quite nicely in the past. I just resume that conversation.
I see. About the interdisciplinarity and the problem solving. And you think that to go back to look at the minutes of the early council meetings would be useful?
I think so.
In finding out some details about
this.
Certainly
my memory trace is that from that intellectual environment that the first council created, there was a feeling, and I think I can remember that, for example, Ted Bray comes to mind, you know, where mm-hmm. he felt that, because he was a man who was outside universities for most of his life,
mm-hmm.
and had a strong view that universities ought to be able to address issues of concern to society, and I would think that he played quite a role in some of the imaginative ideas that were expressed in that first council. And he, his concepts and the first council's concepts were ones in which there was a re-evaluation of what universities ought to be on about, and that one of the kinds of tide changes that I think they saw in mind was that there ought to be, yes, the same degree of care and concern with the intellectual rigour and academic qualities and all those sorts of things that universities have always said they're on about, and thank goodness they are on about, but a greater willingness to address the issues that were of concern to society at the day, bring that knowledge to bear. Now, coming from CSIRO, as I did, I was very in tune with that, because in a way, CSIRO exists, or was brought into existence in the 1920s, because the universities of the day did not at all address some of the major issues of concern to Australia. All the staff were from England, and their interests were the last interest that they had was to think about Australian issues. And so there had to be an organisation like CSIRO at that time. Now, of course, it's different. It's not no longer the thing not to do to become interested in Australian concerns. CSIRO, that the 10 years of my experience with it in the 50s and the 60s, where it was very much concerned with bringing knowledge to bear on what were the issues of concern.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask you if there are any other schools or departments concerned solely with the environment in Australian universities, but you have said that CSIRO outside the university and at the ANU, there was a section concerned with an aspect of the ecology.
Murdoch University in Perth, which began pretty soon after, or almost contemporary with Griffith.
Yes.
They must have had somewhat related thinking. Uh-huh. And I visited them very early on, and they started with a school. They had a school system as well, mm-hmm. and a school of biological and environmental sciences, which still exists and is flourishing quite well.
Yeah.
So it was interesting that the
yes.
two universities that...
At far ends of the
opposite
Australia,
sides, yes. Both had related areas that they ought to bring in environmental concerns as part of the program.
That is interesting. Were they the only two?
At that time,
at that
yes.
time.
Then later on, not too many others followed suit because, of course, it depended, I think, to some extent, on a new university being set up, you see.
Yes.
And what then, I think there was a slight period when the more traditional universities sort of looked around and wondered if environmental issues were a fad that was going to go away or something. Mm. And then when they saw it wasn't, they responded by and large, by introducing environmental studies at the postgraduate level. In other words, I think they found that it was perhaps either too difficult to pull out bits and pieces from existing departments, which were very discipline-bound, and felt that was something that was just too difficult to do, and probably it was. or that the other, perhaps more intellectual view, that more intellectually based view, that really you ought to get your basic grounding in the disciplines at the undergraduate level and then put them together at the postgraduate level. And I respect that view. It's a view that's I don't think is a silly one at all. And so that was the way that many universities went for a significant period of time. Then, and the interpretations of this, I guess, will vary, but during that period of time, I think, you know, there was considerable scepticism or even criticism by the more old established universities concerning development of environmental studies at the undergraduate level. They sort of, I think, felt that that was something that they wouldn't quite do. But then, of course, with the great interests of students in that area, finally, even the established universities recognised that perhaps they'd better respond to this.
Really?
And in recent years, you have seen some of the older universities cobble together, as it were, a programme which is regarded as environmental studies.
Well, it's very good to think that Griffith was so innovative with this. Did you have much contact with other environmental scientists? This would be, apart from CSIRO, largely outside Australia, I suppose, in those days.
Yes, quite a... I spent a period of time in a couple of periods in the United States, and certainly during the time I was with CSIRO, and there was no question that the environmental movement was further developed, the heightening of environmental concern was further along, and that I think certainly helped generate or helped maybe make me more aware of the range of concerns and the ways in which that had impacted upon people. I met some of the Mexican folk, for example, who were regularly drenched with pesticides and so forth when they were working in the field, and the kinds of health problems that they experienced. And so I began to recognise that, there was some issues here that were perhaps not quite so blatant and perhaps not quite so obvious in Australia, but that, at least in health dimensions, although, of course, we've had asbestosis problems, you know, but they weren't well known in those times. But I think, again, harking back to my colleagues in the environmental biology group, in CSIRO, we were fairly aware, I think, as a group.
What about then when you came to Griffith? Did you maintain contacts with scientists internationally that you had known before?
Yes, I did. And I tried to establish contacts too with other folk, particularly in the other university in Brisbane at the time was the University of Queensland, and they were helpful in terms of a disciplinary basis, but again, I think they felt a little bit quizzical about how you could put all this together.
Mm-hmm.
But I mentioned I visited with Murdoch and found that their mm-hmm. thinking was very much in tune with our own. Mm-hmm. And I knew, of course, the group, the department that Ralph Stutcher was heading in ANU, and knowing that they were thinking along similar, even if rather more focused lines.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't feel as though we were sort of launching out on something that was too peculiar or too out of tune with what those forward-thinking scientists and those who were in tune with what the concerns were worldwide were all thinking in similar sorts of ways, I think.
Yes.
But it was by no means universal.
No. And did Griffith School of AES become known internationally?
Yes, it did, and I think fairly quickly, particularly in the United States, where I find it's very well known indeed. But in other countries as well, I think the reputation of some of our early work, for example, we were early on in developing research in land management areas, and that, I think, obtained attention and interests also in some of our ecologists. That was picking up interest internationally as well.
Mm-hmm. You and other members of AES were in demand for projects in other countries, I believe, too.
Yes, we fairly early on, I suppose it was this sisterhood with our modern nation studies, mm-hmm. and a recognition that not only were environmental issues of great importance to Australia and internationally, but our being part of Asia was terribly important as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I visited, and we had a visit early on from Mohamed Siani, the director of a centre in the University of Indonesia, Jakarta, developing a very similar but a postgraduately oriented mm-hmm. Centre for Environmental Studies and Human Resources, as it was called. And so I visited there fairly early on, and in fact the International Development Program, IDP, then asked me to be their liaison officer for environmental sciences in Indonesia. And so I got to know the activities in that area, and they then requested our involvement, and quite a number of our staff went over, and we developed the first environmental impact training programs for the civil servants in Indonesia. Believe it or not, and then we went back and developed a more advanced course, and they're mm-hmm. still going to this day without our direct involvement.
That's good.
And so our links with particularly with Indonesia and Asia, Southeast Asia, were quite strong, and the last 8 or 9 years have been involved particularly with land management issues, and then this got followed up by the Australian Centre for International Agricultural Research, which has funded our projects in Thailand and Malaysia and in Philippines. Looking again at sustainability issues, how can you get away in using land when the slopes might be 70% or more,
yes.
and yet people have just got to live there, and are dealing with those sorts of issues.
And you and other members of the faculty have been visiting Malaysia and...
Yes, that's continued to this day. Recently, in the last 2 years, for example, we have now a link with the Prince of Songkla University in southern Thailand, near the mm-hmm. Malaysian border,
mm-hmm.
and Jeff McDonald in our
oh, yes.
faculty is the IDP person responsible, liaison officer there.
Mm-hmm.
And I visited there recently because they're developing not only a master's program in environmental studies, but a new faculty of environmental management.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's IDP, through IDP, they're seeking our encouragement and assistance, and we're working there with the faculties of resource management, natural resources, and some of the engineering faculties that are also assisting the birth of this new faculty of environmental management.
Mm.
And
what about the Philippines? You were
yes,
involved in a project there too, weren't you?
Yes, I've run training programs in the Philippines for teachers in the secondary area, and been involved with reviews of institutions in different parts of the world, including, say, the Kearney Foundation in the University of California in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But recently, there's been quite a growth in UNESCO and international agencies requesting assistance from staff in their faculty.
Really?
Mm. This has arisen in connection with the Prince of Songkla. We're involved in a UNESCO UniTwin project to try and grow links between not only between ourselves and Prince of Songkla, but with other universities in Indonesia and elsewhere. Bex Brown's been just back from Namibia, where he's been running training programs in environmental impact assessment for the United Nations Development Program. And we're involved in East Europe as well with the Budapest program that Philip Jones will be involved with.
Yes.
And Paul Safinu is the Australian representative for the World Association of Sustainable Agriculture, which has been growing fairly actively in recent years. So, yeah, as you say, we're pretty glued into the rest of the world.
Yes, it's marvellous.
And in fairly substantial and leadership sort of roles.
Yes. And you've said that you had a distinguished scholar from Indonesia visiting the school.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have many other scholars and
yes,
from other countries?
Yes, well, one of the early scholars who visited us going back to very early days was Professor Alan Keast from Queen's University. He's
Queen's is where?
Queen's in Ontario.
Oh, yes.
And he is an Australian originally and contributed very substantially to literature on evolution in the Southern Hemisphere. And he was very great help and stimulus in our, particularly in the ecological dimension of our school in the very early years.
Mm-hmm.
But we've had a very long list of important visitors since then, and only wish that I don't think we've got a visitor's book that's got a record of all those.
That's a pity, isn't it, in a way?
Yeah.
That, it's just got to remain in the memory of people.
Yeah, that's largely true, I think.
Mm. Did AES attract substantial research funds?
Yes, we were very fortunate, especially being a new university and a new school. Then the feeling was that it was fairly difficult in the early years to get funding, because you often how funding comes is from a reputation that you've built up as a group. But with Arthur Bowney and myself and Peter Stevens and others in the early years, we put in a proposal to try and look at some of the issues of soil conservation and land management rather more broadly in the Darling Downs. And this attracted quite substantial support very early on. And so we've done quite well for research funds to this day. Growing too is the in response to requests for work of dealing with particular issues, particular problems, the consultancy work in the faculty has also grown. So that the total in terms of consultancy and research funds that we receive now is quite comparable with what we receive from the Commonwealth. They're about equal.
Oh, that's very good, isn't it?
And of course some activities such as CISA, the Centre for Catchment and Stream Research, depends for its continued growth on consultancy funds.
Not that I really mind, but this should make the government very happy, because it believes that that universities should be attracting money from industry and from elsewhere, and the consultancy program would very much help with this, wouldn't it?
It does indeed. In some cases, just because we're doing things that industry wants so much, for example, the waste management industry in Australia was finding it couldn't appoint Australian people to management positions in the waste management industry, and asked us to get going, and gave the faculty $1 million to try and get programs going and research and other activities going, which of course we're busy doing.
And very successfully too, I believe.
Mm.
Well, what do you consider the greatest achievements of Australian environmental studies or the faculty of environmental science to date?
That's a very good question. I think this development of what I called unconscious interdisciplinarity, in other words, a willingness to bring together knowledge and create knowledge, if it's not there, in new ways to deal with problems and to build that into a teaching program, is something that is, I think, quite a great achievement, because especially folk who've been in universities a long part of their life, and I must say that a lot of our staff have been outside universities for quite a bit of their life, which probably helped in this, find it rather difficult to bring together knowledge and teaching from different disciplinary areas. I think we've certainly contributed greatly to the understanding and heightened the management knowledge of environmental issues in Australia, and especially in the situation where Australia has got many opportunities as well as many problems in the environmental area. I think this was a very timely development. But as I've indicated, I think we've looked beyond Australia, and I think our links with Asia, and I'm just back from a visit to Korea, where again we're developing further in the environmental area links that the university already had with Seoul National and Korea universities. Mm-hmm. I think we've contributed very significantly to those kinds of links as well. I think that another considerable achievement I think that we've made is showing that, putting it simply, that mathematics can be terribly useful. And this is something sadly lacking, I must say, in our school system, and we're involved heavily through our staff in revamping the syllabus in the school system in Queensland.
For mathematics?
For mathematics.
Oh, splendid.
And I hope that instead of mathematics being some sort of arcane and perhaps very interesting activity akin to sort of playing chess or something of that kind, to actually a tool that can be all that, but also actually useful in understanding how the world works and developing an understanding of systems and processes, is something that we've contributed very significantly, and not only to environmental studies, but I think to studies generally. Mm. Not that quantitative methods solve all problems, but they can be very helpful as a tool in solving some of them. I think, too, that we can say that we've made significant contributions in the area of land use and land management in particular, in understanding some of the issues that are worldwide but particularly important in Australia, such as soil conservation. Our biggest export from Australia is soil by wind erosion to other parts of the Pacific around. And we've had significant degradation problems with erosion and with salinity. And I think that we've contributed to understanding in those areas. And I think that the original school, the AES, has contributed also a very important foundation for the growth of the expanded faculty, both in terms of the graduate school with its very large body of students in the higher degree area. Also, it's contributed the foundation for us building into the areas of environmental engineering, which I think will be very important in the future, and our School of Applied Maths and Stats.
Hmm. Well, it's, I think, a great list of achievements. Now, perhaps just one final question. Where do you see the Faculty of Environmental Sciences, as it's now called, going to in the future?
I think the medium-term growth areas are fairly predictable, because the university's already agreed to us expanding into the area of environmental planning, which we have done quite a bit of, but can do more. Mm-hmm. Another area of important growth, I believe, is in the occupational hygiene engineering area, which brings together our interests in understanding the problems of the work environment, which we already teach in our workplace and environment in the Health and Behavioural Sciences program, mm-hmm. but goes beyond that of evaluating, as in our interest in AES, of what does pollution and workplace problems, what health implications are that, and that links up with our health interests. But then there's the question, what do you do about it? How do you redesign the environment? How do you completely rethink the way in which the work environments ought to be, right from heavy industry through chemical industries, through all sorts of industry, right through to the more mundane situations where there can be health and hygiene problems of various kinds. And so bringing this engineering dimension or design dimension to occupational matters, I think, is a growth area that we will start up mid-next year with a diploma in that area for the first time in Australia. And this will expand both within our own faculty and with our links with the health and behavioural sciences. Another growth area underway is with the expansion of our links with the environmental studies and law area, which we've not mentioned, but which is a very important dimension. And we plan, for example, to be in a joint master's program in that area. Looking in the longer term really calls for the crystal ball, I guess. I think talking very broadly, I think that we ought to continue to think very deeply about this question of what is a good life for all, and what does this mean in terms of environmentally responsible development. For much of the world, and I think particularly for Australia and for Africa and Southeast Asia, perhaps not so much for Singapore, but for those parts of the world where wealth depends on the continued sustainable productivity of the land resource, then I see economic deprivation, which you can readily see in Africa in particular. Nothing to remind one with Somalia and so forth these days. Economic deprivation and ecological degradation, I think, are two sides of the same coin.
Mm.
And we've got to, in some way, deal with those sorts of issues, which are complex issues. They're social, political, but they're certainly ecological, and land management issues are involved in there. And the whole emphasis on ecological sustainable development, I guess, is involved in that. And I think in Australia in particular, perhaps we can learn, as I've said earlier, a bit from our Aboriginal folk about just how we can more appreciate and develop an affinity for our land resources and the way that we use our natural environments. I think there's, again, an expanded and continued role for the environmental sciences and environmental engineering, because they can deal in many ways with important classes of environmental issues, provided we understand the social issues that are involved as well. And very often, I think, environmental engineering technology can deal with some of the waste disposal problems very effectively, but we've got to recognise the considerable cynicism that's there in society against these kinds of innovative ideas.
Mm.
I think minimising waste production and energy use, making use of waste, as we mentioned with the tyres, is one example of that. And certainly paying greater attention to environmental protection is something that I see taking place right throughout the world. I think, too, bringing an environmental critique into planning and management, such as our Better Cities sort of activity, is something which we will see grow in the school and in the faculty. One area where I must admit we've been rather weak, not uncaring, but weak, is the whole sort of more philosophical and social values area. Not that we've been unaware or unattentive, but I think that's something that I would like to see grow in strength if it has the opportunity to, particularly giving it some more historical dimension, which we've not been able to pay enough attention to, and raising, you know, basic sort of philosophical issues for society of, in terms of consumption, what's enough, and what's the role for the permanent unemployed that we're predicted as having? Is environmental concerns part of the answer there?
Mm.
Well, that's the sort of things that I dimly see in the crystal ball for the future that hopefully we may be able to pay a bit more attention to than we have in the past.
Well, thank you very much, Calvin. That's a tremendously interesting forecast of what we might be able to hope from in the future. And also, thank you very much for your very clear exposition of how AES came to be and what it's done over the years.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity. I'm afraid it's been rather anecdotal and perhaps wandering in parts, but...
Well, this is an oral history. It's not a university thesis.
True. Yes, it certainly would require some tidying up to achieve those objectives, but certainly getting the... it's been very enjoyable talking with you about some of the early times and trying to see how those roots have come through and affect our present growth. And thank you very much for that opportunity.
Very nice. Thank you, dear.
Oh. Sorry, I'm running a bit late.